Side 7, The Ruby Knight, by David Eddings. Continuing on page 289. Theret looked a little puzzled, but he did as he was told. Euleth hefted one of his rocks. "That's far enough, Beirut," he called. He gave the rock an underhand toss toward the shaky raft. "Mark that place," he bellowed. Theret wiped the water the rock had splashed on him from his face. "Yes, sir, Euleth," he said, poling the raft toward the widening circles on the surface of the lake. Then he took one of his willow saplings and sank one end of it down into the muddy bottom. "Now pull the raft off to the left," Euleth shouted. "I'll throw the next rock a ways beyond you."
"Your left or mine, Sir Euleth?" Theret asked politely.
"Take your pick. I just don't want to brain you with this." Euleth was tossing his rock from one hand to the other and squinting out at the brown-stained waters of the lake. Beirut pushed the raft out of the way, and Euleth launched his rock with a mighty heave.
"Lord," Calton said, "no dying man could ever throw anything that far."
"That was the idea," Euleth said modestly. "That's the absolute outer limit of the area we search." "Beirut," he bellowed in a shattering voice, "mark that spot and then go down. I need to know how deep we're going and what kind of bottom we've got to work with."
Beirut hesitated after he marked the place where the second rock had struck the water. "Would you please ask Lady Sophronia to turn her back?" he asked plaintively, his face suddenly bright red. "If anyone laughs, he'll spend the rest of his life as a toad," Sophronia threatened, resolutely turning her back on the lake and pulling the curious little girl flute around at the same time. Beirut stripped and went over the edge of the raft like an otter. He reemerged a minute later. Everyone on shore, Sparhawk noticed, had held his breath while the agile novice had been down. Beirut exhaled explosively, spraying water. "It's about 8 feet deep, Sir Euleth," he reported, clinging to the end of the raft. "But the bottom's muddy, 2 feet of it at least. Mucky and not very nice. The water's dark brown. You can't see your hand in front of your face."
"I was afraid of that," Euleth muttered.
"How's the water?" Calton called out to the young man in the lake. "Very, very cold," Beirut chattered.
"I was afraid of that, too," Calton said glumly. "Well, gentlemen," Euleth said, "time to get wet."
The rest of the afternoon was distinctly unpleasant. As Beirut had announced, the water was cold and murky, and the soft bottom was thick with brown mud from the nearby peat bogs.
"Don't try to dig around in that with your hands," Euleth instructed. "Probe with your feet."
They found nothing. By the time the sun went down, they were all exhausted and blue with the cold.
"We have a decision to make," Sparhawk said soberly after they had dried themselves and put on tunics and mail shirts. "How long is it going to be safe for us to stay here? The Seeker knows almost exactly where we are, and our scent will lead it right to us. As soon as it sees us in the lake, Azash will know where Beliom is. That's something we can't let him find out."
"You're right, Sparhawk," Sophronia agreed. "It will take the Seeker a while to gather its forces, and a while longer to lead them back here. But I think we'll need to set a time limit on how long we stay in this place."
"But we're so close," Calton objected.
"It's not going to do us any good to find Beliom just to turn it over to Azash," she pointed out. "If we ride off, we'll lead the Seeker away from this spot. We know where Beliom is now. We can always come back later when it's safe."
"Noon tomorrow?" Sparhawk asked her.
"I don't think we should stay any longer."
"That's it then," Sparhawk said. "At noon we'll pack up and go back to the city of Veni. I get the feeling that the Seeker won't take its men into a town. They'd be very conspicuous the way they shamble around."
"A boat," Euleth said, his face ruddy in the light of their fire.
"Where?"
Calton asked, peering out at the night-shrouded lake.
"No, what I mean is, why don't we ride to Veni and hire a boat? The Seeker will follow our trail to Veni, but it won't be able to sniff our tracks over water, will it? It'll camp outside Veni waiting for us to come out. But we'll be back here by then. We'll be free to search for Beliom until we find it."
"It's a good idea, Sparhawk," Calton said.
"Is he right?"
Sparhawk asked Sophronia. Will traveling by water throw the Seeker off our trail?
I believe it will, she replied.
Good. We'll try it, then. They ate a meager supper and went to their beds. They rose at sunrise the following morning, took a quick breakfast, and pulled the raft back out to the markers that indicated where they had left off the previous day. They anchored the raft and once again went into the chill waters to probe at the muddy bottom with their feet. It was almost noon when Bayret surfaced not far from where Sparhawk was treading water and catching his breath.
I think I found something, the novice said, gasping for air.
Then he upended himself and swam down head first. After a painfully long minute, he came up again. It was not a crown he held in his hand, though, but a brown-stained human skull. He swam to the raft and laid the skull up on the logs. Sparhawk squinted up at the sun and swore. Then he followed Bayret to the raft. He hauled himself up on the logs. That's it, he called to Calton, whose head had just popped up out of the water. We can't stay here any longer. Gather up the others and let's get back to shore. When they reached the shore, the sunburned Euleth curiously examined the skull. Seems awfully long and narrow for some reason, he said.
That's because he was a Zamok, Sophronia told him.
Did he drown? Bayret asked.
Euleth scraped some of the mud off the skull and then poked one finger into an aperture in the left temple. Not with this hole in the side of his head, he didn't. He went down to the lake shore and sloshed the skull around in the water to rinse centuries of accumulated mud out of it. Then he brought it back and shook it. Something rattled inside. The big Thalesian laid it on the mounded-up stones of the grave of the Earl of Hayd, took up a rock and cracked the skull open as casually as a man might crack a walnut. Then he picked something up out of the fragments. I thought so, he said. Somebody put an arrow in his brain pan, probably from shore. He handed the rusty arrowhead to Tinian. Do you recognize it?
It's Deir and forging, Tinian said after examining it.
Sparhawk thought back for a moment. Gossick's accounts said that Alcyone knights from Deira came along and wiped out the Zamoks who'd been pursuing the Earl of Hayd. We can be fairly certain that the Zamoks saw the Earl throw the crown into the lake. They'd have gone out after it, wouldn't they? And to the exact spot where it hit the water. Now we find this one with a Deiran arrow in his head. It's not too hard to reconstruct what happened. Bayret, can you pinpoint the precise spot where you found the skull?
To within a few feet, Sir Sparhawk. I was taking bearings on things along the shore. It was straight out from that dead snag over there and about 30 feet out into the lake.
That's it, then, Sparhawk said exultantly. The Zamoks were diving after the crown, and the Alcyones came along and raked them with arrows from the shore. That skull was probably lying no more than a few yards from Beliom.
We know where it is now, Sophronia said. We'll come back for it later.
But we must leave immediately, Sparhawk, and it would be far too dangerous to have Beliom in our possession with the Seeker right behind us.
Grudgingly, Sparhawk had to admit that she was probably right. All right, then, he said in a disappointed tone. Let's break down the camp and get out of here. We'll wear mail instead of armor so we won't be so conspicuous. Euleth, push that raft back out into the lake. We'll wipe out any traces that we've been here and ride on up to Veni. It took them about a half an hour. Then they moved out. They rode north along the lake, moving at a gallop. As usual, Bayret rode to the rear, watching for signs of pursuit. Sparhawk was melancholy. Somehow it seemed that for weeks he had been trying to run in soft sand. No matter how close he got to the one thing that would save his queen, something always seemed to interfere, to force him away from the goal. He began to have darkly superstitious feelings. Sparhawk was an Aline and a church knight. He was at least nominally committed to the Aline faith and its rigid rejection of anything remotely related to what the church called heathenism. Sparhawk had been abroad in the world too long, however, and seen far too many things to accept the dictates of his church at face value. He realized that in many ways he hung suspended between absolute faith and total skepticism. Something somewhere was desperately trying to keep him away from the Beliom, and he was fairly certain he knew who it was. But why would Azash bear such enmity toward the young queen of Elenia? Sparhawk grimly began to think of armies and invasions. If Alana died, he vowed to himself that he would obliterate Zamok and leave Azash weeping alone in the ruins without one single human to worship him. They reached the city of Veni not long after noon the following day, and returned through the gloomy streets to the now familiar inn. "Why don't we just buy this place?" Colton suggested as they dismounted in the courtyard. "I'm starting to feel as if I've lived here all my life." "Go ahead and make the arrangements," Sparhawk told him. "Kurek, let's walk down to the lake shore and see if we can find a boat before the sun goes down." The knight and his squire walked out of the inn yard and down the cobbled street that led toward the lake. "This town doesn't get any prettier when you get to know it," Kurek observed. "We're not here for the scenery," Sparhawk growled. "What's the matter, Sparhawk?" Kurek asked. "You've been in a foul humor for the last week or more." "Time, Kurek," Sparhawk sighed. "Time. Sometimes it's almost as if I can feel it dribbling through my fingers. We were within no more than a few feet of Beliom, and then we had to pack up and leave. My queen is dying inch by inch, and things keep getting in my way. I'm starting to feel a very powerful urge to hurt some people." "Don't look at me." Sparhawk smiled faintly. "I think you're safe, my friend," he said, putting his hand affectionately on Kurek's shoulder. "If nothing else, I'd hate to make wagers on the outcome if you and I ever had a really serious disagreement." "There's that, too," Kurek agreed. Then he pointed. "Over there," he said. "Over there what?" "That tavern. People with boats go in there." "How do you know that?" "I just saw one go in. Boats tend to leak, and the men who own them try to seal up the seams with tar. Anytime you see a man with tar on his tunic, you can be fairly sure that he has something to do with boats." "You're an absolute sink of information sometimes, Kurek." "I've been around in the world for quite a long time, Sparhawk. If a man keeps his eyes open, he can learn a great deal. When we go inside, let me do the talking. It'll be faster." Kurek's stride suddenly took on a peculiar roll, and he banged open the tavern door with unnecessary force. "Hello there, mates," he said in a raspy voice. "Have we chanced by luck on a place where men as works on the water be accustomed to gather?" "You've found the right place, friend," the barman said. "Praise be," Kurek said. "I hate to drink with landsmen. All they can talk about is the weather and their crops, and once you've said it's cloudy and that the turnips is growing, you've exhausted the possibilities of conversation." The men in the tavern laughed appreciatively. "Forgive me if I seem to pry," the barman apologized, "but you seem to have the speech of a saltwater man." "Indeed," Kurek said, "and sore do I miss the smell of brine and the gentle kiss of spray upon my cheek." "You're a long way from any salt water, mate," one tar-smeared fellow sitting at a table in the corner said with an odd note of respect in his voice. Kurek sighed deeply. "Missed me boat, mate," he said. "We made port in Apalia, sailing down from Yoset, up in Thalasia, and I went out on the town and got sore took by the grog. The captain was not one to wait for stragglers, so he upped and sailed with the morning tide and left me beached. As luck had it, I fell in with this man." He clapped Sparhawk familiarly on the shoulder. "And he give me employment. Says he needs to hire a boat here in Veni, and he needed someone as knew the way of boats to make sure he doesn't wind up on the bottom of the lake." "Well now, mate," the tarry man in the corner said with narrowed eyes, "what would your employer be willing to pay for the hire of a boat?" "'Twould only be for a couple of days," Kurek said. He looked at Sparhawk. "What think ye, Captain? Would a half-crown strain your purse?"
"I could manage a half-crown," Sparhawk replied, trying to conceal his amazement at Kurek's sudden alteration.
2 days, you say?" the man in the corner said. "Dependent on the wind and weather, mate, but it's always that way on the water, isn't it?" "Truly. It could just be that we can do some business here. I happen to own a fair-sized fishing boat, and the fishing hasn't been very good of late. I could hire out the boat to you and spend the 2 days mending my nets." Why don't we just nip on down to the water's edge and have a look at your vessel?
Keurig suggested.
It might just could be that we could strike a bargain.
The tar-smeared fellow drained his tankard and rose to his feet.
Come along, then, he said, moving toward the door.
Keurig, Sparhawk said quietly in a pained tone,
don't spring surprises like that on me. My nerves aren't as good as they used to be. Variety keeps life interesting, Captain.
Keurig grinned as they left the tavern in the wake of the fishermen. The boat was perhaps 30 feet long, and it sat low in the water.
She appears to have a leak or two, mate,
Keurig noted, pointing at the foot or so of water standing in the hull.
We were just patching her,
the fisherman apologized.
I hit a submerged log and sprung a seam. The men as works for me wanted to get something to eat before they came back to finish up and bail her out.
He patted the boat's rail affectionately.
She's a good old tub, he said modestly. She responds to the helm well, and she can take whatever kind of weather this lake can throw at her. And you'll have her patched by morning? Shouldn't be no trouble, mate. What think ye, Captain?
Keurig asked Sparhawk.
Looks all right to me, Sparhawk replied. But I'm no expert. That's what I hired you for.
All right, then we'll try her, mate,
Keurig told the fisherman.
We'll come back down sunup and settle up then.
He spat on his hand, and he and the fisherman slapped their palms together.
Come along, Captain, Keurig told his lord. Let's find us some grog and supper, and then a bed. It'll be a long day tomorrow.
And then, with that rolling swagger, he led the way up from the lakefront.
Would you like to explain all that? Sparhawk asked, when they were some distance away from the boat owner.
It's not too difficult, Sparhawk, Keurig said.
Men who sail on lakes always have a great deal of respect for saltwater sailors, and they'll go out of their way to be accommodating.
So I noticed.
But how did you ever learn to talk that way?
I went to sea once when I was about 16. I've told you that before.
Not that I remember, no.
I must have. Maybe it slipped my mind.
What possessed you to go to sea?
As Lottie, Keurig laughed. She was about 14 then and just blossoming out. She had that marrying sort of look in her eye. I wasn't ready yet, so I ran away to sea. Biggest mistake I ever made. I hired on as a deckhand on the leakiest bucket on the west coast of Aeosia. I spent 6 months bailing water out of the bilges. When I got back to shore, I swore I'd never set foot on a ship again. As Lottie was very happy to see me again, but then she's always been an emotional girl.
Was that when you decided to marry her?
Shortly after that. When I got home, she took me up to her father's hayloft and did some fairly serious persuading. As Lottie can be very, very persuasive when she sets her mind to it.
Keurig!
Sparhawk was actively shocked.
Grow up, Sparhawk! As Lottie's a country girl, and most country girls have already started to swell when they get married. It's a relatively direct form of courtship, but it has its compensations.
In a hayloft?
Keurig smiled. Sometimes you have to improvise, Sparhawk.
Chapter 19 Sparhawk sat in the room he shared with Colton, poring over his map while his friend snored on a nearby bed. Eulith's idea of a boat was a good one. Sophrania's statement that it would indeed evade the Seeker's most dangerous means of tracking them down was reassuring. They could return to that lonely mud beach where the Earl of Hayde slumbered and resume their interrupted search without looking over their shoulders for signs of a hooded figure sniffing at the ground behind them. The Zamok's skull Barrett had found on the murky bottom had almost precisely pinpointed Beliom's location. With only a little luck, they would be able to find it within the space of a single afternoon. They'd have to return here to Veni for the horses, however, and that was the problem. If, as they had surmised, the Seeker's blank-minded cohorts likely would be lurking in the fields and woods around the town, they'd have to fight their way out. Under ordinary circumstances, fighting would not have concerned Sparhawk. It was what he had trained a lifetime to do. If he had Beliom in his possession, however, it would not only be his own life he would be risking, but Alana's as well. And that was unacceptable. Moreover, as soon as Azash sensed Beliom's reemergence, the Seeker would hurl whole armies against them in a desperate attempt to seize the jewel.
The solution was simple, of course. All they had to do was to come up with a way to convey the horses to the west side of the lake. Then the Seeker could haunt the region around Veni until it grew old and died without causing Sparhawk and his friends any further inconvenience. The boat that he and Kirik had hired, though, would not be capable of carrying more than 2 horses at a time. The notion of making 8 or 9 separate trips halfway down the lake to deposit the horses on some lonely beach on the west side of the lake made Sparhawk almost want to scream with impatience. Hiring several boats was an alternative, though not a very good one. A single boat probably would not attract attention. A fleet of them, though, would. Perhaps they could find someone dependable enough to herd the horses down the west shore. The only problem with that was that Sparhawk was not sure whether the Seeker could identify the smell of the horses as well as that of the people who rode them. He scratched absently at the finger that bore his ring. The fingers seemed to be tingling and throbbing for some reason. There was a light tap at the door. "I'm busy," he said irritably.
"Sparhawk."
The voice was light and musical, and it had that peculiar lilt that identified the speaker as Styrick. Sparhawk frowned. He didn't recognize the voice.
"Sparhawk, I need to talk with you."
He rose and went to the door. To his astonishment, it was Flute. She slipped into the room and closed the door behind her.
"So you can talk?" he asked, surprised.
"Of course I can."
"Why haven't you, then?"
"It wasn't necessary before. You and Lean's babble far too much."
Although her voice was that of a little girl, her words and inflections were peculiarly adult.
"Listen to me, Sparhawk. This is very important. We must all leave immediately."
"It's the middle of the night, Flute," he objected.
"How terribly observant of you,"
she said, looking toward the darkened window.
"Now please be still and listen. Gwerig has retrieved Beliom. We have to intercept him before he can get to the north coast and sneak aboard a ship bound for Thalesia. If he evades us, we'll have to follow him to his cave in the mountains of Thalesia, and that would take quite a while."
"According to Euleth, nobody even knows where the cave is."
"I know where it is. I've been there before."
"You what?"
"Sparhawk, you're wasting time. I have to get out of this city. There's too much distraction here. I can't feel what's happening. Put on your iron suit and let's go."
Her tone was abrupt, even imperious. She looked at him, her large dark eyes grave.
"Is it possible that you're such a total lump that you can't feel Beliom moving through the world? Isn't that ring telling you anything?"
He started slightly and looked at the ruby ring on his left hand. It still seemed to be throbbing. The small child standing in front of him seemed to know far too much.
"Does Sophrania know about all this?"
"Of course. She's getting our things together."
"Let's go talk with her."
"You're beginning to irritate me, Sparhawk."
Her dark eyes flashed and the corners of her bow-like pink mouth turned down.
"I'm sorry, Flute, but I still have to talk with Sophrania."
She rolled her eyes upward.
"Eline's,"
she said in a tone so like Sophrania's that Sparhawk almost laughed. He took her hand and led her from the room and down the hallway. Sophrania was busily stowing clothing, both hers and Flute's, in the canvas bag sitting on the bed in her room.
"Come right in, Sparhawk," she said to him as he paused in the doorway. "I've been expecting you."
"What's going on, Sophrania?"
he asked in a baffled tone of voice.
"Didn't you tell him?"
she asked Flute.
"Yes, but he doesn't seem to believe me. How can you tolerate these stubborn people?" "They have a certain charm."
"Believe her, Sparhawk," she said gravely to him. "She knows what she's talking about. Beliom has emerged from the lake. I felt it myself, and now Gwerig has it. We have to get out into open country so that Flute and I can sense which way he's going with it. Go rouse the others and have Beirut saddle our horses."
"You're sure about this?"
"Yes. Hurry, Sparhawk, or Gwerig will get away."
He turned quickly and went back out into the hall. This was all moving so rapidly that he did not have time to think. He went from room to room, waking the others and instructing them all to gather in Sophrania's room. He sent Beirut to the stable to saddle the horses, and last of all he woke Colton.
"What's the problem?"
the blonde Pandion asked, sitting up and rubbing sleepily at his eyes.
Something's come up, Sparhawk replied. We're leaving.
In the middle of the night?
Yes. Get dressed, Colton, and I'll pack our things.
What's going on, Sparhawk?
Colton swung his legs over the edge of the bed.
Sophronia will explain it.
Hurry, Colton!
Grumbling, Colton began to dress while Sparhawk jammed their spare clothing into the pack they had brought up to their room. Then the two of them went back down the hall, and Sparhawk rapped on the door to Sophronia's room.
Oh, do come in, Sparhawk. This is no time to stand on ceremony.
Who's that? Colton asked.
Flute, Sparhawk replied, opening the door.
Flute? She can talk?
The others had already gathered in the room, and they were all looking at the little girl they had thought was mute with some astonishment.
To save time, she said, yes, I can talk, and no, I didn't want to before. Does that answer all the tiresome questions? Now, listen very carefully. The troll dwarf Gwerig has managed to get his hands on Beliom again, and he's trying to take it to his cave up in the mountains of Thalesia. Unless we hurry, he'll get away from us.
How did he get it out of the lake when he hasn't ever been able to do that before?
Xavier asked.
He had help.
She looked around at their faces and muttered a naughty word in Styric.
You better show them, Sophronia, otherwise they'll stand here all night asking foolish questions.
There was a large mirror, a sheet of polished brass, actually, on one wall of Sophronia's room.
Would you all come over here, please? Sophronia said, going to the mirror.
They gathered around the mirror, and she began an incantation Sparhawk had not heard before. Then she gestured. The mirror became momentarily cloudy. When it cleared, they seemed to be looking down at the lake.
There's the raft, Colton said in astonishment. And that's Sparhawk coming to the surface.
I don't understand, Sophronia.
We're looking at things that happened just before noon yesterday, she told him.
We already know what happened.
We knew what we were doing, she corrected. There were others there as well, however.
I didn't see anybody.
They didn't want you to see them. Just keep watching.
The perspective in the mirror seemed to change, moving away from the lake toward the sedge that grew thickly on the peat bog. A dark-robed shape was crouched down, hidden in the marsh grass.
The Seeker, Xavier exclaimed. It was watching us.
It wasn't the only one, Sophronia told him.
The perspective changed again, sliding several hundred yards north along the lake to a clump of scrubby trees. A shaggy, grotesquely deformed shape was hidden in the grove.
And that's Gwerig, Flute told them.
That's a dwarf, Colton exclaimed. It's as big as Euleth. How big is a normal one?
About twice as big as Gwerig.
Euleth shrugged.
Ogres are even bigger.
The mirror clouded again as Sophronia spoke rapidly in Styric.
Nothing important went on for quite a while, so we're skipping that part, she explained.
The mirror cleared again.
There we go, riding away from the lake, Colton said.
Then the Seeker rose from the marsh grass, and with it, about 10 wooden-faced men who appeared to be Pelosian serfs. Numbly, the serfs shambled down to the lake shore and waded into the water.
We were afraid that might happen, Tinian said.
The mirror clouded again.
They continued the search all through yesterday, last night, and today, Sophronia told them. Then, just over an hour ago, one of them found Beliom. This part might be a little hard to see because it was dark. I'll lighten the image as much as I can for you.
It was a bit hard to make out, but it seemed that one of the serfs emerged from the lake carrying a mud-caked object in his hand.
King Sarek's crown, Sophronia identified the object.
The black-robed Seeker rushed along the lake shore, its scorpion-like claws extended and clicking eagerly. But Gwerig reached the serf before his ashes creature could. With a mighty blow of his gnarled fist, he crushed in the side of the serf's head and seized the crown. Then he turned and ran before the Seeker could summon its followers out of the lake. Gwerig's run was a peculiar loping gait involving both legs and one extraordinarily long arm. A man might be able to run faster, but not by very much. The image faded.
What happened next? Kurik asked.
Gwerig stopped from time to time when one of the serfs began to overtake him, Sophronia replied. It looked as if he were deliberately slowing down. He killed them one by one.
Where's Gwerig now? Tinian asked.
We can't tell, Flute told him. It's very hard to follow a troll in the dark. That's why we have to get out into the open countryside. Sifrania and I can feel Belion, but only if we can get clear of all these townsmen.
Tinian considered it. The Seeker's more or less out of the picture now, he said. It's going to have to go out and gather more people before it can go after Gwerig.
That's a comforting thought, Colton said. I wouldn't want to have to take them both on at once.
We'd better get started, Sparhawk told them.
Put on your armor, gentlemen, he suggested. When we run across Gwerig, we might need it.
They went back to their rooms to gather their belongings and to dress themselves in steel. Sparhawk clanked down the stairs to settle up with the fat innkeeper, who stood leaning against the doorway of the empty taproom, sleepy-eyed and yawning.
We're going to be leaving now, Sparhawk said to him.
It's still dark outside, Sir Knight.
I know, but something came up.
You've heard the news, then, I gather.
What news was that? Sparhawk asked him cautiously.
There's trouble down in Arsham. I haven't been able really to get the straight of it, but there's even been talk that it might be a war of some kind.
Sparhawk frowned.
That doesn't make much sense, neighbor. Arsham's not like Lemmerkand. The Arshan nobles forswore their blood feuds generations ago at the king's command.
I can only repeat what I heard, Sir Knight. The word that I've picked up is that the kingdoms of Western Aeosia are all mobilizing. Earlier tonight, some fellows came through Veni in quite a hurry. Fellows who weren't very interested in going off to fight in a foreign war. And they say that there's a huge army gathering to the west of the lake, conscripting every man they run across.
The Western kingdoms wouldn't mobilize because of a civil war in Arsham, Sparhawk told him. That kind of thing is an internal matter.
That's what puzzles me, too, the innkeeper agreed. But what puzzles me even more is that some of those timid fellows have said that a fair portion of that army is made up of Thalesians.
They must have been wrong, Sparhawk said. King Worgen drinks quite a bit, but he still wouldn't invade a friendly kingdom. If these men you mentioned were trying to avoid being conscripted, they probably wouldn't have stopped to examine the men who were chasing them. And one man in a male shirt looks much like another.
That's probably very true, Sir Knight.
Sparhawk paid for their night's lodging.
Thank you for the information, neighbor, he said to the innkeeper as the others began to come down the stairway. He turned and went out to the courtyard.
What's going on, Sir Sparhawk?
Theyrit asked, handing Sparhawk Farron's reins.
The Seeker was watching us while we were in the lake, Sparhawk replied. One of its men found Belion, but Gwerig the Troll took it away from him. Now we have to go find Gwerig.
That might be a little difficult, Sir Sparhawk. There's fog rolling in off the lake.
Hopefully it'll burn off before Gwerig gets this far north.
The others came out of the inn.
Let's all get mounted, Sparhawk said to them.
Which way do we go, Flute?
North for now,
she replied as Curic lifted her up to Sifrania. Beirut blinked.
She knows how to talk, he exclaimed. Please, Beirut, she said to him, don't repeat the obvious. Let's go, Sparhawk. I can't pinpoint Belion's location until we get away from here.
They rode out of the inn yard and into the foggy street. The fog was thick, hovering just this side of rainy drizzle, and it carried with it the acidic reek of the peat bogs that surrounded the lake.
This isn't a good night for coming up against a troll, Ulith said, falling in beside Sparhawk.
I doubt very much that we'll run across Gwerig tonight, Sparhawk said. He's on foot, and it's a long way from here to where he found Belion. That's assuming he's even coming this way.
He almost has to, Sparhawk, the Genidian said. He wants to get to Thalesia, and that means he's got to get to a seaport on the north coast. We'll know better which way he's moving once we get Sifrania and Flute out of town.
My guess would be Nadera, Ulith speculated. It's a bigger seaport than Apalia, and there are more ships there. Gwerig's going to have to sneak on board one. It's not likely that he could book passage. Most sea captains are superstitious about sailing with trolls aboard. Would Gwerig understand enough of our language to find out which ships are going to Thalesia by eavesdropping?
Ulith nodded.
Most trolls have a smattering of Aline and even Styrek. They usually can't speak any language but their own, but they can understand a few words of ours.
They passed through the city gate and reached the fork in the road north of Veni shortly before daybreak. They looked dubiously at the rutted track that led up into the mountains toward Gasek, and ultimately to the seaport at Apalia.
"I hope he doesn't decide to go that way," the white-cloaked Bavier said with a shudder. "I don't really want to go back to Gasek."
"Is he moving at all?" Sparhawk asked Flute.
"Yes," she replied. "He's coming north along the lakeshore."
"I don't quite understand this," Talon said to the little girl. "If you can sense where Beliom is, why didn't we just stay at the inn until he got closer with it?"
"Because there are too many people in Veni," Sophrenia told him. "We can't get a clear picture of Beliom's location in the middle of all that welter of thoughts and emotions."
"Oh," the boy said. "That makes sense, I guess."
"We could ride down the lake shore and meet him," Colton suggested. "Save us all a lot of time."
"Not in the fog," Euloth said firmly. "I want to be able to see him coming. I don't want to get surprised by a troll."
"He's going to have to pass through here," Tinian said. "Or at least very close to here, if he's headed toward the north coast. He can't swim across the lake, and he can't go into Veni. Trolls are a little conspicuous, or so I'm told. When he gets closer, we can ambush him."
"It's got some possibilities, Sparhawk," Colton said. "If we got his probable line of travel pinpointed, we can catch him unawares up here. We can kill him and be halfway to Simmera with Beliom before anyone is the wiser."
"Oh, Colton," Sophrenia sighed.
"Killing is what we do, little mother," he told her. "You don't have to watch if you don't want to. One troll more or less in the world isn't going to make all that much difference."
"There could be a problem, though," Tinian said to Flute.
"The Seeker's going to be hot on Gwerig's heels just as soon as it gathers up enough men. And it can probably sense Beliom in the same way you and Sophrenia can, can't it?"
"Yes,"
she admitted.
"Then you're forgetting that we may have to face it just as soon as we dispose of Gwerig, aren't you?"
"And you're forgetting that we'll have Beliom at that point, and that Sparhawk has the rings."
"Would Beliom eliminate the Seeker?"
"Quite easily."
"Let's pull back into those trees a ways," Sparhawk suggested. "I don't know how long it's going to take Gwerig to get here, and I don't want him coming up on us while we're all standing in the middle of the road talking about the weather and other things."
They withdrew into the shadowy cover of a stand of trees and dismounted.
"Sophrenia," Bavier said in a puzzled tone of voice, "if Beliom can destroy the Seeker with magic, couldn't you use ordinary Styric magic to do the same thing?"
"Bavier," she replied patiently, "if I could do that, don't you think I'd have done it a long time ago?"
"Oh," he said, sounding a bit abashed. "I didn't think of that, I guess."
The sun came up blearily that morning. The pervading fog from the lake and the heavy mist out of the forest to the north half clouded the air at ground level, although the sky above was clear. They set out watches and checked over saddles and equipment. After that, most of them dozed in the muggy heat, frequently changing watch. A man on short sleep in sultry weather is not always very alert. It was not long after noon when Talon woke Sparhawk.
"Flute wants to talk to you," he said.
"I thought she'd be asleep."
"I don't think she ever really sleeps," the boy said. "You can't get near her without her eyes popping open."
"Someday maybe we'll ask her about that."
Sparhawk threw off his blanket, rose to his feet, and splashed some water from a nearby spring on his face. Then he went to where Flute cuddled comfortably next to Sophrenia. The little girl's huge eyes opened immediately.
"Where have you been?" she asked.
"It took me a moment to get fully awake."
"Stay alert, Sparhawk," she said. "The Seeker's coming."
He swore and reached for his sword.
"Oh, don't do that," she said disgustedly. "It's still a mile or so away."
"How did it get this far north so fast?"
"It didn't stop to pick up any people the way we thought it would. It's alone, and it's killing its horse. The poor beast is dying right now."
"And Gwerig's still a good ways away?"
"Yes. Beliom's still south of the city of Veni. I can get snatches of the Seeker's thought."
She shuddered.
"It's hideous, but it has much the same idea that we have. It's trying to get far enough ahead of Gwerig to set up an ambush for him. It can pick up local people to do its work for it up here. I think we'll have to fight it."
"Without Beliom?"
I'm afraid so, Sparhawk. It doesn't have any people to help it, and that might make it easier to deal with.
Can we kill it with ordinary weapons?
I don't think so. There's something that might work, though. I've never tried it, but my older sister told me how to do it.
I didn't think you had any family.
Oh, Sparhawk! She laughed. My family is far, far larger than you could possibly imagine. Get the others. The Seeker will be coming up that road in just a few minutes. Confront it, and I'll bring Sophronia. It will stop to think, which is to say that Azash will, since Azash is really its mind. But Azash is far too arrogant to avoid a chance to taunt Sophronia. And that's when I'll strike at the Seeker.
Are you going to kill it?
Of course not. We don't kill things, Sparhawk. We let nature do that. Now go, we don't have much time.
I don't understand.
You don't have to, just go get the others.
They ranged out across the road at the fork, their lances set.
Does she really know what she's talking about? Tinian asked dubiously.
I certainly hope so, Sparhawk murmured.
And then they heard the labored breathing of a horse very near to fatal exhaustion,
the unsteady thudding of staggering hooves, and the savage whistle and crack of a whip.
The Seeker, black-robed and hunched in its saddle, came around the bend, flogging unmercifully at its dying horse.
"Stay, hound of hell!" Bavier cried out in a ringing voice. "For here ends your reckless advance."
"We're going to have to talk to that boy someday," Euloth muttered to Sparhawk.
The Seeker, however, had reined in cautiously. Then Sophronia, with flute at her side, stepped out of the trees. The small Styric woman's face was even paler than usual. Oddly enough, Sparhawk had never fully realized how tiny his teacher really was, scarcely taller than Flute herself. Her presence had always been so commanding that somehow in his mind she had seemed even taller than Euloth.
"And is this the meeting thou hast promised, Azash?" she demanded contemptuously. "If so, then I am ready."
"So, Sophronia," the hateful voice said, "we meet again, and all unexpectedly. This may be thy last day of life."
"Or thine, Azash," she replied with calm courage.
"Thou canst not destroy me."
The laugh was hideous.
"Beliom can," she told the thing, "and we will deny Beliom unto thee and turn it to our own ends. Flee, Azash, if thou wouldst cling to thy life. Pull the rocks of this world over thine head, and cower in fear before the wrath of the younger gods."
"Isn't she pushing this a little?"
Talon said in a strangled voice.
"They're up to something," Sparhawk murmured.
"Sophronia and Flute are deliberately goading that thing into doing something rash."
"Not while I have breath," Bavier declared fervently, couching his lance. "Hold your ground, Bavier," Curic barked. "They know what they're doing. God knows none of the rest of us do." "And art thou still continuing thy unwholesome dalliance with these Aline children, Sophronia?"
the voice of Azash said.
"If thine appetite is so vast, come thou unto me, and I shall give thee surfeit."
"That is no longer within thy power, Azash. Or hast thou forgotten thy unmanning? Thou art an abomination in the sight of all the gods, and that is why they cast thee out, emasculated thee, and confined thee in thy place of eternal torment and regret."
The thing on the exhausted horse hissed in fury, and Sophronia nodded calmly to Flute. The little girl lifted her pipes to her lips and began to play. Her melody was rapid, a series of skittering, discordant notes, and the Seeker seemed to shrink back.
"It shall avail thee not, Sophronia,"
Azash declared in a shrill voice.
"There is yet time."
"Thinkest thou so, mighty Azash?"
she said in a taunting voice.
"Then thine endless centuries of confinement have bereft thee of thy wits as well as thy manhood."
The Seeker's shriek was one of sheer rage.
"Impotent godling,"
Sophronia continued her goading,
"return to foul Zamok, and gnaw upon thy soul in vain regret for the delights now eternally denied thee."
Azash howled, and Flute's song grew even faster. Something was happening to the Seeker. Its body seemed to be writhing under its black robe, and terrible, inarticulate noises came out from under its hood.
With an awful jerking motion, it clambered down from its dying horse. It half staggered forward, its scorpion claws extended. Instinctively, the church knights moved to protect Sophronia and the little girl.
"Stay back!" Sophronia snapped. "It cannot stop what is happening now."
The seeker fell squirming to the road, tearing off the black robe. Sparhawk suppressed a powerful urge to retch. The seeker had an elongated body, divided in the middle by a waist like that of a wasp, and it glistened with a pus-like grayish slime. Its spindly limbs were jointed in many places, and it did not have what one could really call a face, but only two bulging eyes and a gaping maw surrounded by a series of sharp-pointed, fang-like appendages. Azash shrieked something at Flute. Sparhawk recognized the inflection as Styric, but, and he was forever grateful for the fact, he recognized none of the words. And then the seeker began to split apart with an awful ripping sound. There was something inside of it, something that squirmed and wriggled, trying to break free. The rip in the seeker's body grew wider, and that which was inside began to emerge. It was shiny black and wet. Translucent wings hung from its shoulders. It had two huge protruding eyes, delicate antennae, and no mouth. It shuddered and struggled, pulling itself free of the now shrunken husk of the seeker. Then, finally fully emerging, it crouched in the dirt of the road, rapidly fanning its insect wings to dry them. When the wings were dry and flushed with something that might even have been blood, they began to whir, moving so rapidly now that they seemed to blur, and the creature that had been so hideously born before their eyes rose into the air and flew off toward the east. "Stop it!" Bavia shouted. "Don't let it get away!"
"It's harmless now," Flute told him calmly, lowering her pipes.
"What did you do?" he asked in awe.
"The spell simply speeded up its maturing," she replied. "My sister was right when she taught me that spell. It's an adult now, and all of its instincts are bent on breeding. Not even Azash can override its desperate search for a mate."
"What was the purpose of that little exchange of insults?" Colton asked Sophronia.
"Azash had to be so enraged that he would begin to lose his control of the seeker, so that Flute's spell would work," she explained. "That's why I threw certain unpleasant realities in his face."
"Wasn't that a little dangerous?"
"Very," she admitted.
"Will the adult find a mate?" Finian asked Flute in an awed voice. "I'd hate to see the world crawling with seekers."
"It will find no mate," she told him. "It is the only one of its kind on the surface of the earth. It no longer has a mouth, so it can no longer feed. It will fly around in its desperate search for a week or so.
And then?"
"And then?"
"And then it will die."
She said it in a chillingly indifferent voice.
Chapter 20. They dragged the husk of the seeker off the road and returned to the trees to await Gwerig. "Where is he now?" Sparhawk asked Flute.
"Not far from the north end of the lake," she replied. "He's not moving right now. It's my guess that now that the fog has burned off, the serfs have gone to the fields. There are probably so many people about that he has to hide."
"That means that he's likely to come through here after nightfall, doesn't it?"
"It's probable, yes."
"I'm really not very excited about meeting a troll in the dark."
"I can make light, Sparhawk.
Enough for our purposes, anyway." "I'd appreciate it."
He frowned.
"If you could do that to the seeker, why didn't you do it before?"
"There wasn't time. It always came on us by surprise. It takes a while to prepare oneself for that particular spell. Do you really have to talk so much, Sparhawk? I'm trying to concentrate on Belliom."
"Sorry. I'll go talk with Yulith. I want to find out exactly how to go about attacking a troll." He found the big Genidian knight dozing under a tree. "What's happening?" Yulith said, one of his blue eyes opening. "Flute says that Gwerig's probably hiding right now. He's not moving at any rate. He's likely to come past here sometime tonight." Yulith nodded. "Trolls like to move around in the dark," he said. "It's their customary hunting time." "What's the best way to deal with him?" "Lances might work, if we all charge him at the same time. One of us might be able to get in a lucky thrust."
This is a little too serious to be trusting to luck. It's worth a try, for a start anyway. We'll probably still have to fall back on swords and axes. We'll need to be very careful, though. You have to watch out for a troll's arms. They're very long, and trolls are much more agile than they look. You seem to know a great deal about them. Have you ever fought one? A few times, yes. It's not really the sort of thing you want to make a habit of. Has Bayret still got that bow of his? I think so, yes. Good. That's usually the best way to start on a troll. Slow him down with a few arrows, and then move in to finish up. Will he have any weapons? Maybe a club. Trolls don't really have the knack of working in iron or steel. How did you ever learn their language? We had a pet troll in our chapter house at Hade. Found him when he was a cub, but trolls are born knowing how to speak their language. He was an affectionate little rascal, at least at first. Turned mean on us later, though. I learned the language from him while he was growing up. You say he turned mean? It wasn't really his fault, Sparhawk. When a troll grows up, he starts to get these urges, and we didn't have time to hunt down a female for him. And then his appetite started to get out of hand. He'd eat a couple of cows or a horse every week. What finally happened to him? One of our brothers went out to feed him, and he attacked. The brothers couldn't have that, so we decided that we'd have to kill him. It took five of us, and most of us had to take to our beds for a week or so afterward. Eulith, Sparhawk said suspiciously, are you pulling my leg? Would I do that? Trolls aren't really too bad, as long as you've got plenty of armed men around you. An arrow in the belly usually makes them kind of cautious. It's the ogres you've got to watch out for. They don't have enough brains to be cautious. He scratched at his cheek. There was an ogress once who developed an unreasoning passion for one of the brothers at Hade, he said. She wasn't too bad looking for an ogress. She kept her fur fairly clean and her horns shiny. She even used to polish her fangs. They chew granite to do that, you know. Anyhow, as I was saying, she was wildly in love with this knight at Hade. She used to lurk in the woods and sing to him. Most awful sound you ever heard. She could sing all the needles off a pine tree at 100 paces. The knight finally couldn't stand it anymore, and he entered a monastery. She just pined away after that. Eulith, I know you're pulling my leg now. Why, Sparhawk, Eulith protested mildly. Then the best way to get Gwerig out of the way is to stand back and shoot him full of arrows? For a start. We'll still have to get in close, though. Trolls have very tough hide and thick fur. Arrows don't usually penetrate very deep, and trying to do it in the dark is going to make it very tricky. Flute says she can make enough light for us. She's a very strange person, isn't she? Even for a Styric. That she is, my friend. How old do you think she really is? I have no idea. Sophronia won't even give me a clue. I do know that she's much, much older than she appears to be, and much wiser than any of us can guess. After the way she got that seeker off our backs, I don't think it would hurt us to do as she says for a while. I'd agree to that, Sparhawk said.
Sparhawk,
the little girl called sharply.
Come here.
I just wish she wouldn't be so imperious all the time, Sparhawk muttered, turning around to answer the summons.
Gwerig's doing something I don't understand,
she said when he rejoined her. What's that?
He's moving out onto the lake.
He must have found a boat, Sparhawk said. Eulith tells us that he can't swim.
Which way is he going?
She closed her eyes in concentration.
More or less to the northwest. He'll miss the city of Veni and come out on the west side of the lake. We're going to have to ride on down there if we're going to intercept him.
I'll tell the others, Sparhawk said. How fast is he moving?
Very slowly right now. I don't think he knows how to row a boat very well.
That might give us a little time to get there before he does. They broke their minimal encampment and rode south along the west side of Lake Veni as twilight settled over western Pelosia. Will you be able to pinpoint his approximate landing place by the sense you're picking up from Beliom? Sparhawk asked Flute, who rode in Sophrania's arms.
To within a half mile or so, she replied. It gets more precise as he gets closer to shore.
There are currents and winds and that sort of thing, you understand.
Is he still moving slowly?
Even more so. Gwerig has certain difficulties with his shoulders and hips. It would make rowing very difficult for him.
Can you make any kind of guess about when he'll make it to shore here on the west side of the lake?
In his present condition, not until well after daybreak tomorrow. At this point, he's fishing. He needs food.
With his hands?
Trolls are very, very fast with their hands. The lake surface confuses him. Most of the time, he's not even sure which way he's going. Trolls have a very poor sense of direction, except for north. They can feel the pull of the pole through the earth. On water, though, they're almost helpless.
We've got him, then.
Don't plan the victory celebration until you've won the fight, Sparhawk, she said tartly.
You're a very disagreeable little girl, Flute, do you know that?
But you do love me, don't you? She said with disarming ingenuousness.
What can you do? He helplessly asked Sophronia. She's impossible.
Answer her question, Sparhawk, his tutor suggested. It's more important than you realize.
Yes, God help me, he said to Flute. I do. There are times when I want to spank you, but I do love you.
That's all that's important, she sighed.
Then she snuggled up in Sophronia's protective robe and went promptly to sleep.
They patrolled a long stretch of the western shore of Lake Veni, peering out into the darkness that had settled over the lake. Gradually, during the long night, Flute narrowed the area of their patrol, bringing them closer and closer together.
How can you tell? Colton demanded of her a few hours past midnight.
Would he understand? Flute asked Sophronia.
Colton?
Probably not. But you can try to explain it if you'd like. Sophronia smiled. We all need a bit of frustration in our lives from time to time. It feels different when Belion's moving at a diagonal than when it's coming at you head-on, Flute tried.
Oh, he said dubiously. Well, that makes sense, I suppose.
See? Flute said triumphantly to Sophronia. I knew I could make him understand.
Only one question, Colton added. What's a diagonal?
Oh, dear, she said, pressing her face against Sophronia in a gesture of despair.
Well, what is it?
Colton appealed to his fellow knights. Let's swing south a bit, Colton, and keep an eye on the lake, Tinian said. I'll explain it to you as we go along.
You?
Sophronia said to Euleth, who had a faint smile on his face. Not a word.
I didn't say anything.
Sparhawk turned Farron and rode slowly back toward the north, looking out at the dark waters. The moon rose late that night, and it cast a long, glittering path across the surface of the lake. Sparhawk relaxed a bit then. Looking for a troll in the dark had been a very tense business. It seemed somehow almost too easy now. All they had to do was wait for Gwerig to reach the lake shore. After all the difficulties and setbacks that had dogged them since they had set out in search of Belium, the idea of just being able to sit and wait for it to be delivered to them made Sparhawk a little nervous. He had an ominous suspicion that something was going to go wrong. If all the things that had happened in Lemmerkand and here in Pelosia were any indication, something was bound to go wrong. Their quest had been dogged by near disaster almost from the moment they had left the chapter house at Simera, and Sparhawk saw no reason to hope that this situation would be any different. Once again the sun rose in a rusty sky, a coppery disk hanging low over the brown-stained waters of the lake. Sparhawk rode wearily back through the grove of trees from which they kept watch to where Sophronia and the children were waiting.
How far away is he now? He asked Flute.
He's about a mile out in the lake, she replied. He stopped again.
Why does he keep stopping?
Sparhawk was growing increasingly irritated about these periodic halts in the troll's progress across the lake.
Would you like to hear a guess? Talon asked.
Go ahead.
I stole a boat once because I had to get across the Simera River. The boat leaked. I had to stop every 5 minutes or so to bail out the water. Gwerig's been stopping about every half hour. Maybe his boat doesn't leak as much as mine did.
Sparhawk stared at the boy for a moment, and then he suddenly burst out laughing.
Thanks, Talon, he said, feeling suddenly much better.
No charge, the boy replied impudently. You see, Sparhawk, the easiest answer is usually the right one.
Then I've got a troll out there in a leaky boat, and I've got to wait here on shore until he gets all the water out of it.
That pretty well sums it up, yes.
Tinian rode in at a canter. Sparhawk, he said quietly, we've got some riders coming in from the west.
How many?
Too many to count conveniently.
Let's take a look.
The two rode back through the trees to where Carlton, Ulith, and Bavier were sitting their horses, looking off to the west.
I've been watching them, Sparhawk, Ulith said. I think they're Thalasians.
What are Thalasians doing here in Pelosia?
Remember what that innkeeper told you back in Veni, Carlton said, about a war going on down in Arsham? Didn't he say that the Western Kingdoms are mobilizing?
I'd forgotten about that, Sparhawk admitted.
Well, it's none of our concern, at least not for the moment.
Curic and Bayrick rode up.
I think we've seen him, Sparhawk, Curic reported. At least Bayrick has.
Sparhawk looked quickly at the novice.
I climbed a tree, Sir Sparhawk, Bayrick explained. There's a small boat some distance offshore. I couldn't make out too many details, but it looks as if it's just drifting and there seems to be some splashing going on.
Sparhawk laughed wryly.
I guess Talon was right, he said.
I don't quite follow, said Sparhawk.
He said that Gwerig probably stole a leaky boat and that he has to stop every so often to bail out the water.
You mean we've been waiting all night while Gwerig scoops the water out of his boat?
Carlton asked.
It looks that way, Sparhawk said.
They're getting closer, Sparhawk,
Tinian said, pointing to the west.
And they're definitely Thalasians, Ulith added.
Sparhawk swore and went to the edge of the trees. The approaching men were formed up in a column. At the head of the column rode a large man in a mail shirt and a purple cape. Sparhawk recognized him. It was King Worgen of Thalasia, and he appeared to be roaring drunk. Beside him rode a pale, slender man in a highly decorated but somewhat delicate suit of armor.
The one beside Worgen is King Soros of Pelosia, Tinian said quietly. I don't think he poses much of a danger. He spends most of his time praying and fasting.
We do have a problem, though, Sparhawk, Ulith said gravely. Gwerig's going to be coming ashore very shortly, and he's got the royal crown of Thalasia with him. Worgen would give his very soul to get that crown back. I hate to say it, but we'd better lead him away from here before Gwerig reaches the lake shore.
Sparhawk began to swear in frustration.
His suspicions of the previous night had turned out to be all too correct.
We'll be all right, Sparhawk, Bavier assured him. Flute can follow Beliom's trail. We'll get King Worgen some distance away and then take our leave of him. We can come back later and chase down the troll.
It doesn't look as if we have much choice, Sparhawk conceded. Let's go get Sophronia and the children and draw Worgen away from here.
They mounted quickly and rode back to where Sophronia, Talon, and Flute waited.
We're going to have to leave, Sparhawk said tersely. There are some Thalasians coming and King Worgen's with them. Ulith says that if Worgen finds out what we're here for, he'll try to take the crown away from us as soon as we get our hands on it. Let's ride.
They left the trees on the margin of the lake at a gallop, headed north. As they had anticipated, the column of Thalasian troops moved in pursuit.
We need a couple of miles at least, Sparhawk shouted to the others. We've got to give Gwerig a chance to get away.
They reached the road that bore northeasterly back toward the city of Veni and galloped along, rather ostentatiously not looking back at the pursuing Thalasians.
They're coming up fast,
Talon, who could look back over his shoulder without seeming to, called to Sparhawk.
I'd like to get them a little farther away from Gwerig, Sparhawk said regretfully. But I guess this is as far as we can go.
Gwerig's a troll, Sparhawk, Ulith said. He knows how to hide.
All right, Sparhawk agreed.
He made some show of looking back over his shoulder and then held up one hand in the signal for a halt. They reined in and turned their horses to face the oncoming Thalasians. The Thalasians also halted, and one of their number came forward at a walk.
King Worgen of Thalasia would have words with you, Sir Knights, he said respectfully. He will join us presently.
Very well, Sparhawk said curtly.
Worgen's drunk, Ulith muttered to his friend.
Try to be diplomatic, Sparhawk.
King Worgen and King Soros rode up and reined in their horses.
Ho, ho, Soros, Worgen roared.
swaying dangerously in his saddle.
We seem to have snared us a covey of church knights.
He blinked and peered at the knights.
I know that one, he said. Hewlett, what are you doing here in Pelosia?
Church business, your majesty, Hewlett replied blandly.
And that one with the broken nose is the Pandion Sparhawk,
Worgen added to King Soros.
Why are you running so hard, Sparhawk?
Our mission is of a certain urgency, your majesty, Sparhawk said.
And what mission is that?
We're not at liberty to discuss it, your majesty. Standard church practice, you understand.
Politics, then, Worgen snorted. I wish the church would keep her nose out of politics.
Will you ride along with us for a ways, your majesty? Xavier inquired politely.
No, I think it's going to be the other way around, Sir Knight. And it's going to be more than just a ways.
Worgen looked at them all.
Do you know what's been going on in Arsham?
We've heard a few garbled rumors, your majesty, Tinian said, but nothing very substantial.
All right, Worgen said. I'll give you some substance. The Rendors have invaded Arsham. That's impossible, Sparhawk exclaimed. Go tell the people who used to live in Coombe about impossible. The Rendors sacked and burned the town. Now they're marching north toward the capital at Larium. King Dragos has invoked the mutual defense treaties. Soros here and I are gathering up every able-bodied man we can lay our hands on. We're going to ride south and stamp out the Renderish infection once and for all.
I wish we could accompany your majesty, Sparhawk said. But we have another commitment. Perhaps once our task is finished, we may be able to join you.
You already have, Sparhawk, Worgen said bluntly.
We have another urgent commitment, your majesty, Sparhawk repeated.
The church is eternal, Sparhawk, and she's very patient. Your other commitment will have to wait.
That did it. Sparhawk, whose temper was never really all that much under control, looked at the monarch of Thalesia full in the face. Unlike the anger of other men, whose rage was dissipated in shouts and oaths, Sparhawk's grew more and more icy calm.
We are church knights, your majesty, he said in a flat, unemotional voice. We are not subject to earthly kings. Our responsibility is to God and to our mother, the church. We will obey her commands, not yours.
I have 1,000 picked men at my back, Worgen blustered.
And how many are you prepared to lose? Sparhawk asked in his deadly quiet voice.
He drew himself up in his saddle and slowly lowered his visor.
Let's save some time, Worgen of Thalesia, he said formally, removing his right gauntlet. I find your attitude unseemly, even irreligious, and it offends me. With a negligent appearing toss, he threw his gauntlet into the dust of the road in front of the Thalesian king.
That's his idea of diplomacy, Hewlett murmured to Calton in some dismay.
That's about as close as he can usually get, Calton said, loosening his sword in its sheath.
You may as well go ahead and draw your axe, Hewlett. This promises to be an interesting morning. Sophronia, take the children to the rear. Are you mad, Calton? Hewlett exploded. You want me to draw my axe on my own king?
Of course not, Calton grinned. Only on his funeral cortege. If Worgen goes up against Sparhawk, he'll be drinking heavenly mead after the first pass.
Then I'll have to fight Sparhawk, Hewlett said regretfully.
That's up to you, my friend, Calton said with equal regret. But I don't advise it. Even if you get past Sparhawk, you'd still have to face me. And I cheat a lot.
I will not permit this, a booming voice roared.
The man who shouldered his horse through the surrounding Thalesians was huge, bigger even than Hewlett. He wore a mail shirt and an ogre-horned helmet and carried a massive axe. A wide black ribbon about his neck identified him as a churchman.
Pick up your gauntlet, Sir Sparhawk, and withdraw your challenge. This is the command of our mother, the church.
Who's that? Calton asked Hewlett.
Bergston, the patriarch of Emsat, Hewlett replied.
A patriarch? Dressed like that?
Bergston's not your average churchman. Your grace, King Worgen faltered. Put up your sword, Worgen, Bergston thundered.
Or would you face me in single combat?
I wouldn't, Worgen said almost conversationally to Sparhawk.
Would you?
Sparhawk looked appraisingly at the Patriarch of Emsat.
Not if I could help it, he admitted. How did he get that big? He was an only child, Worgen said. He didn't have to fight with 9 brothers and sisters for his supper every night. What's your feeling about a truce at this point, Sparhawk?
It sounds like the course of prudence to me, Your Majesty. We really have something important to do, though.
We'll talk about it later, when Bergston's at prayers. This is the command of the Church, the Patriarch of Emsat roared. The Church Knights will join us in this holy mission. The Ashandist heresy is an offense against God. It will die on the rocky plains of Arsham. As God gives us strength, my children, let us proceed with this great work that we are about.
He wheeled his horse to face south.
Don't forget your gauntlet, Sir Sparhawk, he said over his shoulder. You might need it when we get to Arsham.
Yes, Your Grace, Sparhawk replied through clenched teeth. Chapter 21 Promptly at noon, King Soros of Pelosia called a halt. He instructed his servants to erect his pavilion, and he and his private chaplain retired inside for noon prayers.
Choir boy, King Worgen muttered under his breath. Bergston, he bellowed.
Right here, Your Majesty, the militaristic patriarch said mildly from behind his king. Have you gotten over your siege of bad temper yet?
I wasn't really bad-tempered, Your Majesty. I was merely trying to save lives, yours included.
What's that supposed to mean? Had you been foolish enough to accept Sir Sparhawk's challenge, you'd be dining in heaven tonight. Or supping in hell, depending on divine judgment.
That's direct enough.
Sir Sparhawk's reputation precedes him, Your Majesty, and you would be no match for him. Now, what was it you had on your mind?
How far is Lammercand from here?
The south end of the lake, my lord, about 2 days.
And the closest Lammerc city?
That would be Agnic, Your Majesty. It's just across the border and a bit to the east.
All right, we'll go there then. I want to get Soros out of his own country and away from all these religious shrines. If he stops to pray one more time, I'm going to strangle him.
We'll pick up the bulk of the army late today. They're already marching south. I'm going to send Soros on down to mobilize the Lammerc barons. You go with him. And if he tries to pray more than once a day, you have my permission to brain him.
That could have some interesting political ramifications, Your Majesty, Bergston noted.
Lie about it, Worgen growled. Say it was an accident.
How can you brain somebody by accident?
Think something up. Now listen to me, Bergston. I need those Lammercs. Don't let Soros get sidetracked on some religious pilgrimage. Keep him moving. Quote sacred texts to him if you have to. Pick up every Lammerc you can lay your hands on, and then swing into Elenia. I'll meet you on the Arshan border. I've got to go to Asye in Deira. Obler's called a council of war.
He looked around.
Sparhawk, he said disgustedly, go someplace and pray. A church knight should be above eavesdropping.
Yes, Your Majesty, Sparhawk replied.
That's a very ugly horse you've got there, you know. Worgen said, looking critically at Farron.
We're a matched set, Your Majesty.
I'd be careful, King Worgen, Colton advised over his shoulder as he and Sparhawk started back to where their friends had dismounted.
He bites.
Which one, Sparhawk or the horse?
Take your pick, Your Majesty. The two swung down from their horses and joined their friends.
What's Gwerig doing? Sparhawk asked Flute.
He's still hiding, the little girl replied. At least I think he is. Belion's not moving. He's probably going to wait until dark before he starts out again.
Sparhawk grunted.
Colton looked at Euleth. What's the story behind Bergston? He asked. I've never seen a churchman in armor before.
He used to be a Genidian knight, Euleth replied. He'd be preceptor by now if he hadn't entered the priesthood.
Colton nodded.
He did seem to be carrying that axe as if he knew how to use it. Isn't it a bit unusual for a member of one of the militant orders to take the cloth? Not that unusual, Colton, Bavier disagreed from nearby. A fair number of the high churchmen in Arsham used to be Cyrenics. Someday I myself may leave our order so that I can serve God more personally.
We're going to have to find some nice accommodating girl for that boy, Sparhawk, Eulith muttered. Let's get him involved in some serious sin so that he gives up that notion. He's too good a man to waste by putting him in a cassock.
How about Noeen?
Talon, who was standing beside them, suggested.
Who's Noeen? Eulith asked.
Talon shrugged.
The best whore in Cimera. She's enthusiastic about her work. Sparhawk's met her.
Really? Eulith said, looking at Sparhawk with one raised eyebrow.
It was on business, Sparhawk said shortly.
Of course. But yours or hers?
Do you suppose we could drop this?
Sparhawk cleared his throat, and then looked around to make sure that none of King Worgen's soldiers was within earshot.
We've got to get clear of this lot before Gwerig gets too far ahead of us, he said.
Tonight,
Tinian suggested. Rumor has it that King Worgen drinks himself to sleep every night. We should be able to slip away without too much problem.
We surely cannot disobey the direct command of the Patriarch of Emsat,
Bavier said in a shocked tone.
Of course not, Bavier, Colton said easily. We'll just slip out and find some country vicar or the abbot of a monastery and get him to order us to go back to what we were doing.
That's immoral,
Bavier gasped.
I know, Colton smirked. Disgusting, isn't it?
But it is technically legitimate, Bavier, Tinian assured the young Cyrenic. A bit devious, I'll admit, but still legitimate.
We are oath-bound to follow the orders of consecrated members of the clergy. The order of a vicar or an abbot would supersede the order of Patriarch Bergsten, wouldn't it?
Tinian's eyes were wide and innocent.
Bavier looked at him helplessly, and then he began to laugh.
I think he's going to be all right, Sparhawk, Eulith said. But let's keep your friend Noeen in reserve, just in case.
Who's Noeen?
Bavier asked, puzzled.
An acquaintance of mine, Sparhawk replied distantly. Someday I may introduce you.
I'd be honored, Bavier said sincerely.
Talon went off some distance and collapsed in helpless laughter.
They caught up with the mob of disconsolate-looking Pelosian conscripts late that afternoon. As Sparhawk had feared, the perimeter of their encampment was being patrolled by Worgen's heavily armed thugs. The soldiers set up a pavilion for them just before sunset, and they went inside. Sparhawk removed his armor and put on a mail shirt instead.
The rest of you wait here, he said. I want to take a look around before it gets dark.
He put on his sword belt and stepped out of the tent.
There were two evil-looking Thalesians outside.
Where do you think you're going? One of them demanded.
Sparhawk gave him a flat, unfriendly stare and waited.
My lord, the fellow grudgingly added. I want a check on my horses, Sparhawk said.
We have farriers to do that, Sir Knight.
We're not going to have an argument about this, are we, neighbor?
No, I don't think so, Sir Knight.
Good. Where are the horses picketed?
I'll show you, Sir Sparhawk.
There's no need of that. Just tell me.
I have to accompany you anyway, Sir Knight. The king's orders.
I see. Lead on, then.
As they started out, Sparhawk heard a sudden boisterous voice.
Ho there, Sir Knight!
He looked around.
I see they got you and your friends, too.
It was Kring, the domi of the marauding band of Piloi.
Hello, my friend, Sparhawk greeted the shaved-headed tribesman. Did you catch up with those Zamoks?
Kring laughed.
I've got a whole sack full of ears, he said. They tried to make a stand. Stupid people, the Zamoks. But then King Soros took up with this ragtag army, and we had to follow along in order to collect the bounty.
He rubbed at his shaved head.
That's all right, though. We didn't have anything pressing to do back home anyway, now that the mares have all foaled.
Tell me, do you still have that young thief with you?
Last time I looked, he was still around. Of course, he might have stolen a few things and then bolted. He bolts very well when the occasion demands it.
I'll wager he does, Sir Knight. I'll wager he does.
How's my friend Tinian? I saw you all when you rode in, and I was just on my way to visit him.
He's well.
Good.
The Domi looked seriously at Sparhawk then. Perhaps you can give me some information about military etiquette, Sir Knight. I've never been a part of a formal army before. What are the general rules about pillage? I don't think anybody would get too concerned, Sparhawk replied, as long as you limit your plundering to the enemy dead. It's considered bad form to loot the bodies of our own soldiers.
Stupid rule, that one,
Kring sighed. What does a dead man care about possessions? How about rape? It's frowned on. We'll be in Arsham, and that's a friendly country. Arshans are sensitive about their womenfolk. Worgen's gathered up a fair number of camp followers, if those urges are bothering you.
Camp followers always act so bored.
Give me a nice young virgin every time. You know, this campaign is turning out to be less and less enjoyable. How about arson? I love a good fire. I definitely advise against it. As I said, we'll be in Arsham, and all the towns and houses belong to the people who live there. I'm sure they'd object.
Civilized warfare leaves a lot to be desired, doesn't it, Sir Knight?
What can I say, Domi? Sparhawk apologized, spreading his hands helplessly.
If you don't mind my saying so, it's the armor, I think. You people are so encased in steel that you lose sight of the main things. Booty, women, horses.
It's a failing, Sir Knight. It is a failing, Domi, Sparhawk conceded. Centuries of tradition, you understand.
There's nothing wrong with tradition, as long as it doesn't get in the way of important things.
I'll bear that in mind, Domi. Our tent's right over there. Tinian will be glad to see you.
Sparhawk followed the Falasian sentry on through the camp to where the horses were picketed. He made some pretense of checking Farron's hooves, looking intently out into the twilight at the perimeter of the camp. As he had noted earlier, there were dozens of men riding around the outside.
Why so many patrols? He asked the Falasian.
The Palosian conscripts are unenthusiastic about this campaign, Sir Knight, the warrior replied. We didn't go to all the trouble of gathering them up only to have them sneak off in the middle of the night.
I see, Sparhawk said. We can go back now.
Yes, my lord.
Worgen's patrols seriously complicated things, not to mention the presence of the two sentries outside their tent. Gwerig was getting farther and farther away with Belium, and it seemed that there was very little Sparhawk could do about it. He knew that by himself, using a mixture of stealth and main force, he could escape from the camp. But what would that accomplish? Without Flute, he'd have little chance of tracking down the fleeing troll, and to take her along without the others to help guard her would be to place her in unacceptable danger. They were going to have to come up with some other idea. The Falasian warrior was leading him past the tent of some Pelosian conscripts when he saw a familiar face.
Okuda?
He said incredulously.
Is that you?
The lantern-jawed man in bullhide armor rose to his feet, his bleak face showing no particular pleasure at the meeting.
I'm afraid it is, my lord, he said.
What happened? What forced you to leave Count Gossick?
Okuda looked briefly at the men who shared the tent with him.
Might we discuss this privately, Sir Sparhawk?
Certainly, Okuda.
Over there, my lord.
I'll be in plain sight, Sparhawk told his escort.
Together, Sparhawk and Okuda walked away from the tent and stopped near a grove of sapling fir trees that stood so closely together that they precluded the possibility of anyone's pitching a tent among them.
The Count has fallen ill, my lord,
Okuda said somberly.
And you left him alone with that madwoman? I'm disappointed in you, Okuda.
The circumstances have changed somewhat, my lord.
Oh?
The Lady Bellina is dead now.
What happened to her?
I killed her.
Okuda said it in a numb voice.
I could no longer bear her endless screaming. At first the herbs the Lady Sophrenia advised quieted Bellina somewhat, but after a short while she seemed to shake off their effects. I tried to increase the dosage, but to no avail. Then one night, as I was pushing her supper through that slot in the tower wall, I saw her. She was raving and frothing at the mouth like a rabid dog. She was obviously in agony. That's when I made the decision to put her to rest.
We all knew it might come to that,
Sparhawk said gravely.
Perhaps. I could not bring myself simply to slaughter her, however. The herbs no longer quieted her. The nightshade, however, did. She stopped screaming shortly after I gave it to her.
There were tears in Okuda's eyes.
I took my sledge and broke a hole in the tower wall. Then I did as you instructed with my axe. I've never done anything so difficult in my life. I wrapped her body in canvas and took her outside the castle. There I burned her. After what I had done, I could not face the Count. I left him a note confessing my crime and then went to a woodcutter's village not far from the castle. I hired servants there to care for the Count. Even after I told them there was no longer any danger at the castle, I had to pay them double wages to get them to agree. Then I came away from that place and joined this army. I hope the fighting starts soon. Everything in my life is over. All I want now is to die.
You did what you had to, Okuda.
Perhaps. But that does not absolve me of my guilt.
Sparhawk made a decision at that point. Come with me, he said.
Where are we going, my lord?
To see the Patriarch of Emsat.
I could not enter the presence of a high churchman with Lady Bellina's blood on my hands.
Patriarch Bergsten is a Thalesian. I doubt that he's very squeamish. We need to see the Patriarch of Emsat, he told his Thalesian escort. Take us to his tent.
Yes, my lord.
The sentry led them through camp to the pavilion of Patriarch Bergsten. Bergsten's brutish face looked particularly Thalesian by candlelight. He had heavy bone ridges across his brows, and his cheekbones and jaw were prominent. He was still wearing his mail shirt, although he had removed his ogre-horned helmet and stood his axe in the corner.
Your Grace, Sparhawk said with a bow, my friend here has a problem of a spiritual nature. I wonder if you could help him.
That is my calling, Sir Sparhawk, the Patriarch replied.
Thank you, Your Grace. Okuda here was at one time a monk. Then he entered the service of a count in northern Pelosia. The count's sister became involved with an evil cult, and she began to practice rites involving human sacrifice, which gave her certain powers.
Bergsten's eyes widened.
At any rate, Sparhawk continued, when the count's sister was finally stripped of those powers, she went mad, and her brother was forced to confine her. Okuda took care of her until he could no longer bear her agonies. Then, out of compassion, he poisoned her.
That's a dreadful story, Sir Sparhawk, Bergsten said in his deep voice.
It was a dreadful series of events, Sparhawk agreed. Okuda feels overcome with guilt now, and he's convinced that his soul is lost. Can you absolve him so that he can face the rest of his life?
The armored Patriarch Bergsten looked thoughtfully at Okuda's suffering face, his eyes at once shrewd and compassionate. He seemed to consider the matter for several moments. Then he straightened, and his expression grew hard.
No, Sir Sparhawk, I can't, he said flatly.
End of side 7. To continue, turn the cassette over.